Welcome to Civics and Coffee. My name is Alicia, and I am a self-professed history nerd. Each week, I'm going to chat about a topic on U.S. history and give you both the highlights and occasionally break down some of the complexities in history and share stories you may not remember learning in high school, all in the time it takes to enjoy a cup of coffee. Hey peeps, welcome back. I recently had a chance to speak with writer Michael Woolreich. He is the author of the critically acclaimed Unreasonable Men and Blowing Smoke. He joined me to discuss his latest book, The Bishop and the Butterfly, which tells the story of New York City corruption in the height of the Jazz Age through the murder investigation of Vivian Gordon. We held our chat over Zoom, so I'm inserting my normal sound quality warning here. I hope you all enjoy the conversation. Hey everyone, with me today is Michael Woolreich. He is an author whose work has appeared in Rolling Stone, The Atlantic, and New York Magazine. He has written several books, including the topic of our conversation today, The Bishop and the Butterfly, Murder, Politics, and the End of the Jazz Age. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And so let's dive right on in. What prompted you to write the story of Gordon and Seabury?
Historically, I've written about politics. Both of my last two books were about politics, one about contemporary politics, one about history of the progressive movement during Theodore Roosevelt's time as president. So I started from there, and I was looking around, poking around FDR's time as governor, because, you know, FDR's presidency has been written about to death, but nobody knows much about what he was doing as governor, for a good reason, because he wasn't doing a lot as governor. He saw the governorship as kind of a stepping stone to the presidency. But one of the things he did was he initiated an investigation into Tammany Hall, which was the corrupt political machine that used to ruled New York for over a century. And I was looking around, you know, I was kind of exploring, educating myself on these investigations, which were led by a man named Samuel Seabury, people called him the bishop. That's the bishop in the title. And I found a reference to a murder of a woman named Vivian Gordon. And I had never heard of her. And no, few other people seem to have either. It was, I had to dig around to find, you know, some information about her. And it turned out that, first of all, it was a fascinating murder case. And secondly, it played an important role in those anti-corruption investigations, which ended up having a huge impact on New York City's history and also affected FDR's presidential campaign. So, and the story was just the story of this woman's murder and this investigation. I mean, it was huge at the time. It was, you know, dominated the headlines for months, not just in New York City, but it was national news. I found references to it in Sydney, Australia, in Singapore. It was a really big case that was, you know, all but forgotten now. And so when I read about it and I found myself sucked in by this incredible story, I realized that I had a book there. It's two stories, really. One is the story of these anti-corruption investigations led by Samuel Seabury, and the other is this murder investigation of Vivian Gordon, of the murder of Vivian Gordon, and these two stories intertwined, and so I sort of tell them both together throughout this book.
Yeah. And you referenced Tammany Hall in your prior answer, but, you know, for those who may not know, what was Tammany Hall, and what role did it play specifically in New York politics?
Well, so for much of American history, our political system was dominated by these organizations, corrupt organizations that were known as political machines. Every state and most big cities had one or more political machines representing, you know, one of the major parties. The oldest, most powerful, and arguably most corrupt was in New York City, and that was it was called Tammany Hall, and it controlled the Democratic Party in New York City. It had been founded during the American Revolution as a fraternal order known as the Society of St. Tammany. Tammany was a reference to a legendary Lenape chief. And the early members of this organization fetishized the Native Americans. They would, they'd braid with tomahawks and face paint. But some of the politicians found, as this organization grew, they found it was they could use it for political purposes. One of the earliest was Aaron Burr, actually, who famously shot Alexander Hamilton. You know, he used the Society of St. Tammany to help mobilize voters. Over time, this organization became more and more political and more powerful until it wasn't the politicians using the organization, it was the organization using the politicians. And they would, you know, the bosses of this, of Tammany Hall, could essentially handpick the Democratic nominee for mayor and for any other position in the city. And because New York was a Democratic city, those guys usually won. But it wasn't even just the city. I mean, New York City was 9% of the U.S. population at the around in the early 1900s. So that meant that Tammany Hall controlled a lot of the delegates, both at the state convention, so they could, you know, pick the governor too, and even at the national convention, they had such a big block of delegates that they could play kingmaker at the Democratic National Convention.
Yeah, so major players in the political arena. And your book details a widespread investigation into political corruption. So how did a seemingly random murder investigation prompt the downfall of some of the biggest political names in New York?
As I mentioned, the Tammany Hall and most of the political machines were very corrupt. There was no accountability because the bosses essentially selected, or their lieutenants selected, all of the people who might have held them accountable, the judges, the prosecutors, the cops. All these people owed their jobs to Tammany Hall. So when the bosses, you know, demanded bribes or raided the city coffers, they would look the other way. And that corruption went all the way down. It was, you know, it wasn't just the bosses. It was the building inspectors. It was the magistrates. It was, you know, the cops who were shaking down illegal casinos and brothels. You know, and we think about corruption. We think about people stealing money, and no one likes corruption, but it seems a little victimless sometimes. But it wasn't. And one of the things that they uncovered, that Seabury's investigation uncovered, was this shocking conspiracy by cops, by vice cops and prosecutors and defense attorneys, to frame innocent women for prostitution. There was a court, it was called the Women's Court. It was dedicated to women. And, you know, of course, at that time, most of the cases were called vagrancy, but it was sex workers. It was prostitution. And what these cops were doing, they were essentially setting up innocent women, bringing them down to the women's court, kind of steering them towards these crooked defense attorneys who would, you know, promise to get them off if they paid this outrageous fee. And so if women could afford the fee, then the defense attorney would provide kickbacks to the cops, bribes for the prosecutors, and they would, you know, make sure that the case was dismissed. If the women couldn't afford to pay that fee, then they were almost invariably convicted and sent to the reformatory. There was a reformatory upstate for women called Bedford Hills, New York. And when this news came out, you know, when Seabury's investigators discovered it, I mean, New Yorkers were shocked. It's one thing for a building inspector to take bribes, but, you know, for these innocent women to have their lives ruined, you know, so some cops could, you know, grease the palms. It was sort of a stunning revelation. And it created a lot of political pressure to expand the investigation. And Vivian Gordon turned out to be tied up in this scandal, because she had led a life of crime, but what it had set her in the life of crime was an arrest in 1923 by one of these vice cops, one of these dirty vice cops. And she claimed that she'd been framed, and she went to the investigators to tell her story. And 5 days later, she was murdered. So everyone's assuming the cops bumped her off to keep her quiet. And that, you know, when you combine what was already a shocking revelation with this sensational murder of a, you know, beautiful underworld figure in New York, it just became explosive.
Yeah. And I think the one of the things that was striking to me as I was reading it is I kept wondering, would the investigation have been so pervasive and so kind of wide sweeping had it not been tied to the murder of a woman, right? Because this was very much that period of women still seen as kind of these, for lack of better phrasing, angelic figures. And so that was something that I thought you spun very well of kind of really putting Gordon's influence and her murder and the shock and awe of that murder into kind of perpetuating the investigation further. The investigation into Gordon's murder does have an interesting link to Franklin Roosevelt's future presidential bid. So can you share a bit about why then Governor Roosevelt became invested in the case?
Certainly. So FDR was he's a legend, but he was also a very cunning and very political and very ambitious person. And so he had set his sights on the presidency from, you know, a very young age. He wanted to follow the footsteps of his cousin Theodore, and, you know, would confided to one of his friends in his 20s that, you know, these are the steps I'm going to take. And then he pretty much followed them. So he started his political career in the state legislature in New York, much like his cousin, TR, and as a opponent of Tammany Hall. You know, that's how he made his name and got elected. But unlike Theodore, who was a Republican, Roosevelt, FDR was a Democrat. And that made it a little bit tricky, actually, to be opposed to Tammany Hall because they had so much control over New York politics. And he learned this lesson when he ran for the U.S. Senate and was defeated by a Tammany nominee who wasn't even in the country. He was he was an ambassador to Germany. but, you know, FDR realized that he was not going to get anywhere as a Democrat in New York by opposing Tammany Hall. So he made his peace and they had an alliance, and he worked with the bosses. You know, he wasn't part of Tammany Hall, but they worked together. Tammany Hall supported him when he ran for governor. And so despite the corruption, he was very reluctant to take on Tammany Hall, particularly since he was at this time already planning to run for president. You know, this was 1930, right? And so he was, you know, laying the groundwork to run in 32. And Tammany Hall, as we mentioned, controlled, you know, so many delegates that he really needed their support for him to win the Democratic nomination of the National Convention. I mean, they controlled New York State pretty much. And if he didn't win New York State at the convention, he was dead in the water. So he really didn't want to antagonize them. On the other hand, you know, as all these corruption scandals started coming out, he also didn't want to look like he also didn't want to look weak. He didn't want to look like he was, you know, controlled by Tammany Hall. So he felt he had to do something. So he initially started this investigation with limited, restricted scope. You know, he wanted to investigate some, there were some judicial scandals. So he initially appointed Samuel Seabury to, you know, find out what he could about bribes among these judges. Samuel Seabury found out about this, you know, conspiracy in the women's court, and all of a sudden it became a bigger deal. But Roosevelt was still trying to contain the investigation and had seemed to be succeeding until the Vivian Gordon case happened. And then it was just explosive. And FDR knew it right away. As soon as he saw the news, he was on the phone. He's like, we got to get this, you know, we got to solve this case, get it resolved and get it, you know, get past it. You know, cause he wanted, you know, he needed it taken care of before he went to the National Convention. So he put a lot of pressure on the police to solve it, but it was a very difficult case and they struggled to solve it. Even they had like 200 cops assigned to the case. The district attorney hired the Pinkerton Detective Agency, a private agency, to assist the cops to solve the case. And as the story became even more sensational as it went on, FDR reluctantly expanded Seabury's authority and allowed him to investigate Tammany officials all over the city, including the mayor himself, Mayor Jimmy Walker.
Yeah. And this, you know, this story was so big, as you were saying, you were finding references to it in Singapore and other countries. And so what was the role and influence of the press on the investigation?
Oh, it was tremendous. I mean, that's what created the political pressure. I mean, it was such a sensational case. Even staid newspapers like the New York Times, you know, were putting it on the front page and covering it in detail. But especially the new tabloids, which had only started, you know, a decade or so earlier, particularly the Daily News, which was America's first tabloid. And they were called tabloids because they were tabloid size, which was half of a traditional paper. So it was easier to hold on the subway and it was cheaper. And they, you know, they were filled with photos and they focused on lurid stories of crime and sex. And, you know, this story of Vivian Gordon was all of that. I mean, she was, she'd been a prostitute. She'd seduced some of New York's richest men and then blackmailed them. And then she was murdered. She was strangled to death, with a rope, and, you know, her body was left in Van Cortlandt Park in the Bronx. So it was this huge story for the Daily News and other tabloids. And so they just milked it. And that, you know, New Yorkers were reading the story and eating it up. And so that, you know, added to the tremendous pressure that FDR was under and the police were under to address this case.
Yeah. And in reading the book, it really felt like Samuel Seabury was the right man at the right moment. And so just curious if you could speak on, you know, how did he and his background influence the investigation?
So Samuel Seabury, so the reason people called him, there were two reasons people called him the bishop. One, he was the great-great-grandson of the Right Reverend Samuel Seabury, who was America's first Episcopal bishop. People may know the name because he famously tangled with Alexander Hamilton during the Revolution. He was a loyalist. And so the Samuel Seabury from the book was a judge. All of his ancestors were, they were all in the clergy. He was not. He went into law and, you know, became a judge. But he inherited that kind of moral stature and disposition of his ancestors. He was very, very self-righteous, very, like, completely clean cut. He didn't swear. He was always, you know, perfectly groomed and, you know, eloquent with his deep voice. So when people called him the bishop, it was mocking, you know, his ancestry and his moralistic attitude. He was unusual because he was an anti-Tammany Democrat. And that's why FDR picked him, because he was, you know, he was a guy with unquestioned integrity, who opposed Tammany Hall, but he wasn't a Republican from the other party who, you know, would just try to use it to, you know, get Republicans elected. So he seemed right to FDR. Now, at the time, some of FDR's associates were like, oh, why'd you pick this guy? He's so ambitious. He just wants to make a name for himself, and he's going to really blow this investigation up. And that's exactly what happened. And FDR perhaps regretted his choice later on, because Seabury was very tenacious and, you know, very, very smart about how to use the press and popular opinion to help expand his investigation and do what he wanted to do, which was, first of all, to take on Tammany Hall, like take it all the way to the top. And then he also, you know, he was actually toying with running for president himself. So he was hoping that it would be a springboard for that. He was far too wooden, I think, to be a good candidate, but these were his ideas.
Yeah. And one of the things that I really liked learning about is that your book includes excerpts from Vivian Gordon's diary. So just from a historical analysis and methods perspective, I was like, oh my gosh, how did you locate this? And how did it help you really in crafting the story?
So, you know, I didn't find it right away. And I was, you know, I was really trying to get and I didn't know where it would be. And I was trying to get the, because the case was officially, it's a cold case, never been solved. I was trying to get the case records from the NYPD, thinking that it, you know, might be there among the evidence. I filed a couple of FOIL requests, which were rejected because the archive is in the facility that houses it, was heavily damaged during Hurricane Sandy, which, you know, over a decade ago. And so it's not accessible. And, you know, there were little snippets that the press got hold of, published kind of throughout the investigation. So I had those. But then turned out in July, after the case had gone to trial, the Daily News actually published the entire diaries in two articles. So I was able to get it from that. Some of the names have been redacted, but other than that, it was complete. And then I could use the diary I found was, I mean, you know, it was kind of, you know, the diary was exciting. That's what made it, you know, partly what made news at the time. And, you know, I think that helps the narrative of the book, but it also allowed me to present Vivian Gordon's voice, because I jump back in time about her a little bit, but she's, you know, she's murdered at the beginning of the book. So, and, you know, there really was not a lot of information about her life before, certainly not quotes by her, and she didn't have other diaries that I was able to find. So by presenting the diary, I was able to let her speak and, you know, speak about how she viewed, you know, herself and her world, as well as, you know, the way she talked. You know, she had this, you know, you can really bring out the kind of the slang of the 1920s, you know, by presenting just what she wrote.
And how does this story of the quote, Bishop and the butterfly, help us understand our current moment?
Yeah. So first of all, the bishop is Samuel Seabury. The butterfly is Vivian Gordon. She was, the press called her a Broadway butterfly because she would hang around Broadway. You know, we have, corruption has never gone away. It's not nearly today as bad as it was, you know, back in this era. But I do worry that we might be slipping in that direction. I mean, in, you know, here in New York City, you know, we have a mayor who's, you know, been investigated by FBI. He's got, you know, a number of associates who have been indicted. He's in many ways quite similar to Mayor Jimmy Walker, who is the mayor one during these investigations. I mean, Jimmy Walker was, you know, he would dress very well. He had a personal tailor and would change his outfit multiple times a day. He brought like hundreds of clothes on, like costumes on a European tour. And he was also very much into the nightlife. He liked to party. He was on, it would see him on Broadway, and people called him the night mayor. Eric Adams likes to call himself the nightlife mayor. And he's also known for his style, his clothing style, his expensive clothing, and his expensive tastes in entertainment. So, you know, there are parallels there, certainly in New York City, but even more broadly at a national level. What people don't appreciate, one of the reforms that really helped put an end to the machine rule and the boss rule were civil service laws that required civil servants to take examinations and to prohibited politicians from demoting them or firing them at will. And that prevented the bosses from being able to pick and choose who was running the government. And so those those laws were established at the national level back in the 1800s, the late 1800s. And in New York City, in the mid 20th century, under Mayor LaGuardia, who after Jimmy Walker resigned in disgrace, LaGuardia swept in, and he was a Republican and anti-Tammany. And he put in all these civil service protections that really broke Tammany Hall's grip on power. And, you know, those are something we need to watch. I mean, Donald Trump, in the waning days of his presidency, established an executive order. It was called Schedule F, I believe, that basically was trying to gut the civil service laws. You know, he said it was about you know, defeating the deep state. Mm-hmm. But really what he wants to do and is promised to do if he's elected again is to replace, you know, many people in the government with loyalists. And, you know, that could have this effect of actually empowering machines, political machines and bosses to play a new role and bring new corruption to American politics. So that's worrisome.
Yeah, very good corollary. And so what do you hope people take away from your book?
So I write, you know, I'm not an academic historian. You know, I do think that I've found some things in the story that people have overlooked, historians have overlooked, particularly the role of this murder. But primarily, I'm trying to reach a broader audience and educate people on, you know, what happened in New York City and in the United States in general, and what the world was like and why it was like that. And that's why telling these two stories appealed to me. On one hand, we have this suspenseful, sensational murder case that can really, you know, draw our readers in. And the other, we have this important history that happened in New York City. And so I would like to entertain as well as educate readers about this world back then, and hopefully they can take from it some understanding of, you know, how our world is working today and, you know, which way we may be headed.
Yeah. And I definitely like the way you told the narrative, because I am somebody, obviously, who really likes to connect history to people in all of its various forms. And one of the things I really enjoyed about your book is that, you know, you're taking on this kind of huge historical story, but it's told in a way that's very accessible and almost, you know, like a novel. So I think you did. I think you hit the nail on the head there in terms of your goals.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome. And where should people go when they finish your book and they want to learn more about this story?
Well, it depends what they would like to learn about. I mean, there's a great biography of Samuel Seabury, if they're interested in learning more about him. It's called The Man Who Rode the Tiger by Herbert Mitgang, who is a famous historian. So that's a really interesting read. If they're more interested in kind of the seedy New York in the 1920s side of the story, I recommend another biography actually called Madam. It's a biography of Polly Adler, who is a famous, in kind of the biggest brothel tycoon in New York City at this time. She knew Vivian Gordon, and I talk about her in my book, and in this book, Madam by Debbie Applegate, which is a wonderful biography. She also talks about Vivian Gordon and their connection, and she talks a lot about the gangsters at the time, and, you know, the crooked vice cops, and, you know, how they were interacting with Polly and her organization. And so that's just a really great way to kind of dip into the 1920s and get really educated about what was happening outside the political scene.
And then where should people go when they finish your book and want to learn more about you and your work?
I have a website. It's just my name, michaelwoolreich.com. And, you know, I have all the book reviews are there, of course, and I'll put up this podcast there. Also I have, you know, a list of articles that I've written, a newsletter people could sign up to join. So as I, you know, continue to write and, come out with new books.
And speaking of continuing to write, I know you just put the bow on this book, but is there a new project on the horizon that you can talk about?
There is not yet. I'm still in the exploratory phase. You know, I'm open to ideas. If any of your listeners wants to, you know, I have a contact button on my website. I don't necessarily want to do, I may or may not do true crime again, but I really liked writing narrative nonfiction, and I really want it to be a dramatic story that I can tell that, again, is also sort of educating people about previous and important time.
And is there anything we haven't covered that you'd like to make sure future readers know?
No, I don't think so. I mean, the We talked a lot about the politics and not as much about Vivian Gordon's story, and I think readers will find it really interesting. So I encourage them to read the book and, you know, dig into that and see how they feel.
All right. Thank you. And then for all the listeners out there, be sure to pick yourself up a copy of The Bishop and the Butterfly. Michael weaves an intriguing, fast-paced narrative that you won't want to put down. Thank you again, Michael.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
And there you have it, folks. My thanks again to Michael for coming onto the show. If you are interested in the Gilded Age and Progressive Era and want to take a deep dive into the corruption of New York politics, I highly recommend picking up The Bishop and the Butterfly. You can learn more about Michael and his work through the show notes on my website at www.civicsandcoffee.com. Thanks, peeps. I'll see you next week. Thanks for tuning in, and I hope you enjoyed this episode of Civics and Coffee. If you want to hear more small snippets from American history, be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for joining me, and I look forward to our next cup of coffee together.